Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello?
Hello, could I please speak with Walter Mosley?
Yes. Hi, how you doing, Paul?
Walter, what a pleasure to have you on the Quarantine Tapes. Thank you so much for taking the time. I'm so happy to be reaching you. Tell me, how have you been living these last 3 or 4 months of this this moment in our history, as it were?
Well, you know, I've been in Los Angeles because I was already, when it happened, when the sheltering in place stuff happened, I was already in LA, and I was working in a writer's room. And so, I just stayed. I've been living down in Santa Monica, off the ocean. And, this kind of life, being at home and writing, is what I've done most of my professional life. So it actually feels good.
How is it different?
Well, I mean, it's different from, being in a writer's room where you get up every day and you go to work and you spend hours in the writer's room talking to all these people about, whatever you're working on the series, on either your episode or somebody else's. I don't have anything against that, though. I much prefer just to be at home. I feel much more productive when I'm at home writing and, just concentrating on what I'm doing. So it's different and in a way, better. I mean, the pandemic is a problem and, it's awful and people are dying and, that stuff. And that's really terrible, that awareness. But as far as myself being in my house working, I'm happy doing that.
And you spent some time in working in rooms with writers. And how is that experience for you? I know you've had some surreal experiences with human resources. I was reading about that. It's a wild experience, and it felt wild reading it. And I was thinking, my goodness, even more wild thinking about the present circumstances.
Well, we're going through a very kind of strange time in America, and maybe outside of America also, where the idea of language and how language is used and what it means and stuff has been called into question. My problem was in one writer's room, the writer's room I usually work in, Snowfall's been great, but in one room I was in, people were saying, well, there's certain language you can't use, certain words you cannot say, and I'm like, but I'm a writer and this is America and it's freedom of speech. What do you mean I can't say words? What is this? I think most people disagree with me to say, well, listen, there are words that are just, you can't use them. You can't have them. If you do use them, you're going to lose your job. And that makes sense to most people. It doesn't make sense to me. I think that everybody has a right to say what they're thinking. Whether or not I agree with them and whether or not I want to fight with them over it is another issue. But, I don't know. I think that in America's, social political changes over time, we have to go through this period, and so we do.
Would you be able to say online now on the radio show what the word was that you were not supposed to say?
Oh no, the word I used was, I was told a story about how when I was a kid in Los Angeles, I stopped on Robertson Boulevard and the officer stopped me and he searched me and he questioned me and he searched me again and he questioned me and searched me again and he questioned me. I was like, 16, 17.
Right.
And when he was leaving, I said, excuse me, officer, why did you stop me? I mean, I wasn't doing anything. And he said, listen, when I see a nigger in a Patty neighborhood, I stop him. And when I see a Patty in a nigger neighborhood, I stop him because they're usually up to no good. Now, I was just told that story. I didn't call anybody any names, but I used the language that the policeman used. Because
right.
That's what he was trying to say. And, it was an issue for him. And then when I told the story, it was an issue for that particular room I was in. People were saying, no, you can't say that.
It's extraordinary.
That's what was said to me. Yeah,
it's right. extraordinary. You know. And human resources brought you in to tell you that there are certain words, particularly it's interesting as a writer,
that you cannot utter.
You know, which reminds me so much of a moment at the New York Public Library where I used to work. We did a tribute to George Carlin, and there was this fantastic moment, Walter. This fantastic moment, Walter, where George Carlin's daughter said there was never a better moment in George's life than when the Supreme Court justices had to utter the seven words you're not allowed to say on television. He felt vindicated.
They said it.
It's great.
Well, you know, that, well, it becomes the thing, you know, it's that, well, you understand.
I do. And, you know, in your book, Working on the Chain Gang, you write most of popular entertainment and so-called news is really an attempt, conscious or not, to distract us from thinking too much about the truth, about the reality of our lives. What is, one might say, the reality we're being distracted from most of the time, or perhaps even all of the time?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And I think it's different in different parts of the world, different countries, different cultures, different histories, different languages. But I think in America, there's a really powerful attempt by the people who control wealth, who also control the media, to distract us from what's best for us, to distract us from democracy, to distract us from where we sit inside the culture. I mean, I live in a country where 80% of the people are working class people, but 80% of the people also believe that they're middle class people. You know, can't both be right. Can't have two 80%. But you have a real confusion, and that confusion, I think, is supported and abetted by the media, either consciously or unconsciously. Yeah.
You know, one of the sentences that I've used quite often on the quarantine tapes, a guiding quotation, and as you know, I'm a quotomaniac by profession. There's this wonderful line of Blaise Pascal where he says, "All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room." Powerful.
And very true. I mean, it is the ability to, because if you are able to sit quietly in a room, which is, you know, kind of an objective statement, you can be able to consider, well, what is the issue? Who am I? What am I doing? Where am I going?
Right.
What are my answers? And, you know, of course, we don't have that. And I think probably most people in the world don't have it. Most countries, most language groups. I mean, a lot of times people talk about human beings. They say we're social beings. The truth is we're semi-social beings.
Right.
You know, we're competitive. We fight. We struggle against each other. And that's how we advance. And a lot of that is okay. But when you have a thing like the pandemic, you really kind of have to be able to work together, have knowledge. And, of course, we live in a country where people don't actually believe their political leaders. They don't believe what the media is saying. They don't believe a lot of things that are being expressed. And to a great degree, that's true. But, you know, when you have something like a pandemic and people are dying by the thousands, and people are saying, well, I just don't believe that that's true. I don't believe that that it's happening. I think everybody's lying to me. There's some truth to everybody lying, but also there's some truth to a pandemic. So how do you deal with that? It becomes very, very, very delicate, very difficult.
But, you know, going back to the first quotation, yours, when you said to distract us from thinking too much about the truth, it reminded me of that moment where Toni Morrison says the function, the very serious function of racism is distraction. It keeps you from doing your work, and in a sense, this is what's happening. This pandemic, the two viruses we're living through, the virus of racism and everything it entails, and the pandemic of COVID-19 is perhaps opening up the possibility of thinking differently. Do you think so?
I do. I mean, I think that there is a potential, a possibility of thinking differently on a lot of different levels. But also at the same time, I think it's there that you have a lot of avoidance of that possibility. That you know, people are saying, I just don't believe this. I don't believe that. I don't believe that. It might be somebody who doesn't believe, you know, in the government. It might be somebody who doesn't believe in the issues of race and racism. It's history. And so it's a very delicate and difficult moment. Also, I mean, you have the other thing. A lot of people can't bear to be separated from people. Mm-hmm. They can't bear to not be out and social and at the bar, at the restaurant, at the club, at the dance, at the concert, at the casino, wherever they enjoy people. They can't do it, and it's not a conscious decision. It's a drive. It's almost an instinct that they need to be with other people. So, I mean, it's so complex when you start to wonder about how we're living, how we're doing in this world.
How we're doing, and also this notion that is coming back again and again when we return to normal. Well, in so many ways, the whole point is not to.
Well, yes. Well, you know, I have a friend, we were talking one day at the very beginning of all this, and she said to me, you know, there's something really good about this pandemic. And I said, what's that? And she said, well, it's not Ebola. So we're really making a lot of mistakes dealing with the pandemic, understanding it. You know, people who are saying that it's not real, or the government who's trying to respond, but they don't understand enough yet to be able to respond. Which is the beginning of this, but she said, comparatively, it's not as dangerous if it's something like the bubonic plague, which you and I have discussed before, or Ebola, where you know you're saying, 92% of people who get this are going to die. I suppose there's a moment to think about it as something positive, to say, oh,
it's not as bad.
This is a practice run.
It's not as bad as some other pandemics have been in the past. Now,
and maybe in the future.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Well, yes, you're saying.
You described, I was so taken by that, Walter, you described your father as a black Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. What did you mean?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of people in America, of different races who are poor but very intelligent, who don't have access to, education or wealth or the media, whatever, but who have an ability to approach the truth by discussion, by talking. So, so somebody says, well, this is happening. So, well, if that's happening, then how can this be happening? And if that's the problem, how can that? And there's a moment where truth is expressed, but not necessarily disseminated. I thought my father liked that, but there are a lot of people like that in the world who are very intelligent, very capable. This friend of mine, not a very well-educated friend of mine, but who understands, this is a good thing about the pandemic, because the next, when something that's really dangerous comes about, we'll have been through this and we'll know how to respond to it. And I was really amazed. I went, wow, you're really smart. She's much younger than I am. But I was like, wow, that's actually true.
But when I read you saying that you considered your father as a black Socrates, and then and then after that, I read that if you had to choose a writer you would want to be in the company of, you said it would be Homer.
Homer. He's the beginning of our literary tradition, the West. And I think that he really talked about people as people, and a lot of that is, a lot of people, most people write about people, as we wish they were.
Right.
But he concentrated on who we were, in spite of our flaws.
You spent perhaps over 15 years working on the novel John Woman, which was turned down by so many different publishers. Why do you think it was so much harder than usual to get that particular book published after a long career you've had of publishing, I don't know, more than 24 books.
Well, actually, almost 60.
Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. I miscounted.
No, that's okay. That's all right. But the thing is, I don't even know. I wrote a book. I've written a lot of mysteries, but not only mysteries. I've written literary and short fiction and science fiction and nonfiction, but I've written plays. But this was a book about a deconstructionist historian. And I kind of, the feeling I got was that I had no right to be talking about such a thing. And because there's a notion, I think, in America and in writing today that you have to, like in The Wizard of Oz, you have to get, you have to have the degree, you have to have the medal, you have to have the something to prove that you are what you are. You know, I mean, and most people don't know that I didn't finish, but I worked for my doctorate in political theory. And I know exactly what deconstructionist thinking is. But, the world, didn't want to pay attention to it and publishers. And it was amazing. People kept on turning me down. I had a woman write me a note saying, well, Walter, if you would like, this is after I've written 50 books, right? She says, Walter, if you want to come meet with me, I can explain to you what a novel really is.
Thank you.
I was like, whoa,
But you explore in it ideas about history and power, and maybe the people who were reading it or not reading it were worried about what you might come up with.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe they were. What I really talk about is the how it's impossible to really know history. Like there are most things that we think of as we project ourselves in the future. So one day I'll understand the atom. One day I'll understand the speed of light. One day I'll understand dark matter, because it's in front of us and we can understand it. History is another thing completely. In order to know your history, you have to know everything that happened from the Big Bang all the way up. Honestly, in the end, without knowing that, you can't know everything. You can't know what you're talking about completely. So it becomes a kind of a deconstructionist thing. It's up to how we think about it and how we perceive it, and that's how we express.
History now, in so many ways, is coming into the fore in an interesting way in America, it seems to me, with the ongoing debate around monuments. And I had occasion recently to speak with the artist William Kentridge, and he was saying that, in his view, one of the ways of dealing with this problem is maybe to take some of those monuments simply off their pedestals.
but they would still be there, but they would be like off the pedestal.
Yeah, burying them sort of half underground. And I'm wondering, what do you think if it were up to you, what do you think we should do with these monuments? I know they're all different, but I'm wondering how you, because in a way the monuments do contain a certain history. What's interesting is that
contain a certain perception of history.
That's right. That's right.
I think the issue has to be what the government invests in. If it's a public monument, and it's celebrating, some great general in the Civil War, and there were great generals, Robert E. Lee among them, or other people who have done. Things that other people would be unhappy about, Christopher Columbus or whoever. The problem always becomes, there's nothing wrong with having the statue and having the representation. The problem becomes to deal with the government and its perception of, history and politics, I mean, Christopher Columbus certainly existed, but, the idea that he discovered a country that was already populated is kind of ridiculous. Or celebrating Civil War generals or Yankee generals for that matter. Southern generals or Yankee generals. It becomes very difficult, because at one point we're talking about freedom of speech. On another point, we're trying to say, well, what is our government doing? What is our government support? And, most of the, many of the statues that people are upset about were, supported and put in place by people who were either in the Ku Klux Klan or who were sensitive toward those beliefs. And I'm always confused by it. It's like, I think that everybody should be out there in the world. But I also know that most people of color in the United States are not represented. Their participation is not represented, their existence is not.
When you say,
and
every,
that's a problem.
When you, Walter, when you say everyone is should be out there, do you mean in a sense leaving the monuments there is a good occasion for dialogue?
Well, that would be, if we could get to the place where that could happen,
yeah,
it would be wonderful. I'm not sure we can, but if we could get to a place where people are saying, well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about really what Christopher Columbus did and didn't do. Mm. You know, that would be wonderful. To say that I want to silence that is less wonderful than talking about it. You know what I mean? Though I understand that a lot of people have already said this. Listen, I'm not represented here. There's no statues about me. You know, I built this country. it's a very interesting, we do need, what you're saying, we do need to be able to discuss who we are, what we've been, where we're going. And where we are, we stop at the point where we're arguing, we're fighting, we're saying this, you know, you can't have that. You can't have, you know, Frederick Douglass and something. Well, you can't have Robert E. Lee. Well, you can't have this and that. And that's all good and well. And I understand the arguments. But in the end, I would much rather have the discussion. You say, when a man says that he's discovered a country, shouldn't that country not have any people in it? Because if there's people there already, they've already discovered the country. You know, that kind of thing, you know.
There's a book by a man named David Lowenthal, a wonderful geographer who wrote The Past is a Foreign Country. And in it, he says, you know, the Elgin Marbles are in London, and they won't be returned to Greece. But mm-hmm. perhaps what we should do is, when we go and visit the Elgin Marbles in the British Museum, perhaps what we should have there is on the walls the very debate taking mm-hmm. place. A dialogue, in a sense, between London and Athens. And when you go to the museum in Athens of the Acropolis, they did something absolutely extraordinary, which is they left everything that isn't there sort of empty, giving you the sense that, you know, mm-hmm. the marbles are elsewhere.
What's missing.
What's missing. And this made me think very much about our present situation, because on the one hand, we're having this incredible debate about the monuments. On the other hand, in public schools and perhaps also in private schools, we're barely teaching history.
Well, certainly. And this has actually always been true in America, the thing that's wrong is our knowledge. We're really able to argue and fight, say, I don't like you, or I don't like you, or this is wrong, or that's wrong. But the interesting moment is to understand who we are and where we come from. But, you know, if you talk to most, so-called white Southerners, they fought and died in a war. 90% or more of the people who did weren't slave owners, weren't landowners. They were fighting for something that didn't matter for them. And, and maybe they would have done that anyway, but to have that discussion today would be really extraordinary.
Yeah.
Or to have to talk to, you know, to African-Americans, not that I like that term all that much, but to talk to African-Americans and to say, this is what you did to build this country. You know, you're some of the oldest inhabitants of North America before the Native Americans, you know. The so-called white people came, and you were right on their trail, you know, right after them, first as colonists, then as slaves. To have that discussion opens up who I am and therefore what I think I am.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Why don't you like that term, African-American?
Well, I mean, Africa is a continent. It's not a country.
Right.
You say Italian-Americans, German-Americans, Franco-Americans, you know, and all of a sudden you have African-Americans. You say, well, Africa's a big place. What kind of African-American am I? You know, am I from Ivory Coast? You know, am I from, you know, one of the great empires, like the Empire of Mali? Or, you know, what, you know, and you know, it just becomes a thing, you know. It exposes the ignorance of Americans, because most Americans don't know anything about Africa. If people come up to me and say, I'm from Namibia, and I go, oh, yeah, you just had that war. And they go, you know something about that? You know, so I'm from Eritrea. So, oh, yeah, that's the country that, you know, broke off from Ethiopia, and they've been fighting. And they go, you know that? You know, because, you know, most Americans don't.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you know, I mean, if you can be a Franco-American, you can also be an Ethiopian-American, right? I mean, but we aren't. We're slave Americans. I mean, we came as slaves. And we were all mixed up and blended together and, you know, raped by the masters. And, you know, our history is a lot different than a continent that none of us remember.
Walter, you once said, in a great mystery, we find the crime being investigated reveals a deeper rot. What is a deeper rot revealed, let's say, by the crimes of police brutality now?
Well, you know, I mean, the crimes of America, I mean, most and many police departments started off by keeping people of color, ex-slaves, in their place.
Right.
And also people who couldn't vote, meaning to say people who didn't own property, and those were, you know, so-called white people. I think that there's, you know, there's such a deep crime right there, right, in what the job of the police is, you know, to protect the property, you know, of the wealthy, and to keep everybody else down. I mean, that would certainly be it as far as the police is concerned. And, you know, this movement now, you know, it's a misnomer, but to say to defund the police, it becomes a very interesting thing, because what it means is to redefine the job of the police.
Right. Yeah. You know, I recently spoke with Suketu Mehta. When I asked him what he heard when I said defund the police, what that slogan meant to him, he said very interestingly, along your lines, he said, let's not defund the police, but let's refund it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it becomes absolutely true that, you know, the job that the police once had was keeping, you know, non-white and impoverished white people in chains, basically keep them in their place. That's what it has been, and it's never been, you know, a job of making, you know, America safe and protected and to be able to understand itself.
Because you've spent so much of your life immersed in detective stories. If you had to at this moment articulate it, what would you say the role of policing in America could become if we think that this moment of the pandemic actually offers us an opportunity for change?
You know, that's a very hard question. I don't completely know the answer. My work has been basically to expose what is wrong, you know, with the police department. I just finished an E.C. Rollins novel that's coming out in January called Blood Grove. Mm. And, this guy can't pay E.C. his money, so he lets him have his Rolls Royce for a year, and at the end of the year, he'll pay him the money. And E.C. is, you know, 69. He's trying to drive around L.A. The police stop him every 8 blocks. And they come up, you know, and they say all this insulting stuff to him. And he just realizes that he's spent so many minutes in his life that he could have created a 13-year-old child. Yeah. And, you know, it's true. I mean, it's true. But I mean, and to recognize that, because, you know, most people think that what the police do is to protect and serve, and they don't. What they do is they try to keep certain people down and protect the property of everybody else. And that's what I would talk about. And then from there, we could start to try to come up with some answers about what to do about that.
Walter, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you. All Too Brief. I hope we see each other soon when we can.
Absolutely.
It would really be a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking this call, and stay safe. And I can't wait for the book to come out in January. I hope.
Well, before that, in September, I have a book coming out called The Awkward Black Man, which I'm really happy about also.
How excellent. Walter, take care of yourself. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Talk to you later, Paul.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.